From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz, and this morning, Lynn Ware Peake speaks with Dr. Partha Nandi, who specializes in gastroenterology and internal medicine. He explores five pillars of enhancing your gut, which will in turn optimize your cognitive health. Then, in our ongoing series featuring print media that's thriving and likely on your coffee table, Jay Burke and Lynn Ware Peake speak with Cade Critchko of ORI Magazine. It's a magazine for travelers and curiosity seekers and is powered by local creatives all around the world. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these words.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Well, many of us by now have heard of the intricate connection between the gut and the brain. And our next guest explains it in a no-nonsense, very approachable manner. Dr. Partha Nandi specializes in gastroenterology and internal medicine and is an international health advocate, keynote speaker, and media expert whose approach to health and wellness combines Eastern and Western techniques and philosophies. He's also the host of the Dr. Nandi Show with millions of viewers worldwide. And he joins me today to discuss his book, Heal Your Gut, Save Your Brain, The Five Pillars of Enhancing Your Gut and Optimizing Your Cognitive Health. Dr. Nandi, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hey, pleasure to be there. I love The Mountain Life. I'm in Michigan. We don't at The Mountain Life here. So always good to have The Mountain Life. I remember, you know, where were we at? I think this is not quite what you're talking about, but we were in Lake Tahoe and then it was amazing to be in the mountains. My kids, it's the first time they were there. So it's a different way of life and I'm glad that I can be part of it.
Thank you for joining. And yes, it is a different way of life, I think. And by the way, we consider Lake Tahoe area the mountain life as well, very much. And, you know, I think that people want that not only their bodies, but their brains to perform, especially with all the ways of life that we have here in the mountains. It's very important to have all systems functioning. And, you know, we talk a lot on the show about the connection between the gut and the brain. You take it sort of one step further. You say that our microbiome influences our health as much or more as the genes that we inherit from our parents. How so?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? So it used to be, Lynn, that we would say, you know what? Our life is kind of predetermined almost. You know, it's like, this is what I was born with. And I've got, you know, we always heard he's got good genes or she's got good genes. What I would offer to you is that, you know, your life and your health is in your hands. You're kind of the architect of your health. And here's what I'm talking about. I mean, when we talk about just the gut, for example, you know, the gut microbiome, for those of maybe folks who are not, you know, quite familiar, it's the trillion member army that's in your gut. You know, bacteria, viruses, fungi, protozoa, all these are in concert with each other when they're positive, when they're in good health. But when you have a negative microbiome, it's the opposite. It can actually hurt your gut and make your life different. So why is that? Well, let's just talk about the gut and the brain just for, you know, that's what I talk about in my book, but it affects all of your health and I'll talk about that more. But just your gut and your brain. Remember, the gut and the brain are intimately connected. So we have this information superhighway called the vagus nerve. It's bidirectional. And I often tease my kids that the gut and the brain talk to each other more than two teenagers at a Taylor Swift concert. You know, they're constantly talking. And so if the gut is not healthy, it'll let the brain know that. And the brain then, you know, acts accordingly. And if that happens millions and millions of times a day, you can see intuitively that the gut has to be healthy. So what else happens in the gut? Well, this microbiome does something else. It creates products that actually can change your mood and your brain health. So for example, we may have heard of something called serotonin. That's your feel-good hormone. There are tons of drugs out there that increase your serotonin, make it more effective. Well, it may surprise you that 90%+ of the serotonin in the body is created in the gut by this trillion member army. So if you don't change that and change that to be more positive, you may not be able to have the adequate amounts of serotonin and other we call them neurotransmitters or chemical signals that are not just directly connected, but they go through the blood. They go through your body's systems to be able to uplift you, right? To be able to give you that motivation. So sometimes maybe when you had those cheesy fries with that pepperoni pizza with the extra pepperoni washed off with that diet drink, you're wondering, how come I'm not motivated in the morning? It may be that your gut is not producing the stuff it wants to. So it's just a kind of a simple example. The other part of the gut that's super important is the gut wall. We have to remember between poop on one side and blood is one cell layer thick with a little bit of mucus that's covering it. So that gut wall has to be tight. It has to have integrity. But when you feed it stuff like I just talked about, foods that are processed, foods that are artificial, it can increase inflammation in the gut. That inflammation then begins in the gut, and the gut has the most sophisticated immune system. When it sees crap there, it doesn't know what to do with it, so it starts attacking it. And when those little attacks start to become cumulative, it can cause little cracks in the wall of the gut, and we call that leaky gut. And leaky gut used to be really a term for holistic doctors and people like my colleagues, like gastroenterologists, would roll their eyes when they saw leaky gut. But now we call it intestinal permeability. We could look under the microscope lens and see that the basement membrane has leaks and stuff is going through. And that leaking and that inflammation doesn't just start and end in the gut. It goes in your bloodstream, can go into other parts of your body, including the brain. The brain has this thing called the blood-brain barrier. It then disrupts it. That inflammation can then start the inflammation in the brain. When that happens, right, then you have unopposed inflammation and can cause problems in the brain. Diseases like Alzheimer's. When you see the brain of an Alzheimer's patient, they have neurofibrillary tangles. So in English, that means spaghetti. It's so scarred up that the neurons were supposed to fire, can't fire. You can't do simple activities every day that you can, like remember what to do. And simple things that you want to do every day. Same thing with Parkinson's, same thing with people with strokes. So when it comes back to your question, is it really your genes that are causing it, or is it the environment that you create? And I offer to you, and I give a five-pillar method of really how to change your gut to be able to not only change your brain, but to change your life. And we now know that if you do that, certain parts of your genome, what we used to think are wasted, are now kind of reactivated. We call that epigenetics, where we actually can change what your genes are creating. Imagine that. So you are as powerful as you want to be, right? But to me, the five-pillar method is super important because if you do want to uplift your health, there has to be, to beginning, the first pillar has to be a why. Why the heck should I care about who this Dr. Nandy is and what he's saying to me? Why should I even care about one sentence of this, right? I don't give a crap. Once you have your why, you'll start giving a darn. For me, my why is this, that I want to be around for my kids and my grandkids. Hopefully not a nursing home hooked up to some tubes, barely recognizing them. That's not what I want to be. I'd like to be thriving in their world, giving them sage advice, playing and walking with them. So that's my why. Whatever your why is, once you figure that out, it changes the equation completely. And not less than a dozen studies have shown that you can change your life, not just your brain and your gut health. For sure you can do that, but changes heart disease, cancer, autoimmune disease, if you have a purpose-driven life. Why? Because we have this phenomenon called the fight or flight mechanism or fight or flight phenomenon. And what that means, and you probably know this, but maybe some of your viewers and listeners, what happens is that when we were hunters and gatherers, right, we wanted to just make sure that we had lunch and that we were not lunch for some creature. So we had the fight or flight, which allowed us to survive. And that was great, right? It was great episodically. But now we have that constantly. I'm in Detroit. And when I'm driving down the street, many people very, very creatively tell me how much they hate how I drive, right? They give me all kinds of, middle fingers and this and that. That's just the beginning of it. Then you have people like, your work life or your family life, your spouse may be yelling at you, or you may be upset at something that's happening that's out of your control. This unabated stress, it could be an election cycle. There's so many things that bother you. So when you have a purpose-driven life, guess what? Those things are not as important because you have your focus. You're not in disarray. So that fight or flight mechanism is decreased, and you decrease your cortisol and your sympathomimetic system. That's your first pillar. The second one is intuitive, which is your diet or your food. When you talk about the gut, people say, "Well, I just have to stop with the crap that I'm eating." Absolutely. But I say more than just that. You have to do something fundamental. Go into your kitchen. Actually find your kitchen, go inside and have and do more than just have a cup of coffee or watch TV. Actually cook foods that are whole. I don't believe in diets, Lynn. I just say have a mostly plant-based diet where you're creating your own meals. And I do that with my kids. And again, if you're doing that 80 to 90% of the time, you're great. You don't have to be perfect. 10 to 20% of life, you can live 20% of the time, you can live your life, right? You don't have to be able to say, "I want to go to a party and give them my menu choice of whole food." As long as you're doing 80 to 90%, you're still doing better than 95% of Americans. And when you do that, what you're doing is you're feeding your microbiome, you're feeding your gut the stuff that it needs. When you give it that pepperoni pizza with the cheesy fries and your diet drinks, like I talked about, what you're doing is you're feeding them the wrong stuff, because this stuff has been there for the last 50 years. For the last 10,000 years, your gut has been used to using other foods as fuel. So it's my second pillar. The third one is move.
Wait, before, sorry to interrupt you, but before we
Sure.
go on to the third one, I would love to give our listeners a real mind's eye view of what happened. When you explain the gut wall and being one cell thick, that gives us a big view of how we can damage that gut wall and why leaky gut syndrome has become so prevalent and why things like autoimmune disease has increased, has just grown exponentially. Can you give a view of what happens when we're in that fight or flight, going back to the first pillar, in terms of cortisol, when we're releasing that fight or flight, those hormones, the cortisol, the things, what exactly is it doing to our gut?
So a number of things, right? So it's a good question. So when you have cortisol and other factors of inflammation just means your body's irritated. And when you have an infection, it's okay, right? You want that your body to be inflamed to be able to kill the bug. But when there's no bug and you're inflaming your body, pointlessly. So cortisol is one mechanism in which you do that. When you have unopposed cortisol and when you have unopposed mechanisms where your body is then ravaging not just your gut, but the entire body. It's creating an inflammatory system where these cells that are supposed to help you are now on the on position, and they start attacking microscopically your gut. And when it creates that opening, so now the stuff that's supposed to be in your intestine, right? Those particles are now going into your blood. And then begins the whole cascade of, as you alluded to, autoimmune disease, where these cells, right, the immune cells that are in your body are now attacking microscopically. But that happens once in a while, right? That's okay. That's what I mean by my 90-10 or 80-20. If it happens once in a while, that's okay. But if it happens constantly, which is happening in most Western cultures and now throughout the world, because most of the world has taken on our lifestyle, then that unopposed inflammation that's happening all the time spreads to other parts of your body. In this book, I talk about how it affects brain, how it can break down the blood-brain barrier, but it can also go to your joints. It can go to your heart. It can go to various parts of your body and begin the process of inflammation. Remember, every disease that you can think of has an inflammatory component to it, including malignancies. When you think about, for example, what is skin cancer, right? You have something coming in your skin causing inflammation, that unopposed inflammation then leads to cell disorder, and cell disorder become, you talk about the multiple cells multiplying and you have cancer. Same thing in the esophagus and other parts of your body. What do you do when you're smoking? You're irritating, you're inflaming the lungs and other parts of your body. So the unopposed inflammation from fight or flight can really ravage the gut wall. And then when you have leaky gut or intestinal permeability, then you can start inflammation. That inflammation can then result in your entire body being inflamed and causes things like brain fog. My patients would come to see me and say, "I can't function because I can't think clearly." Well, it could start in your gut. But the beautiful thing is that you can repair it with simple things. And that's what I talked about in my pillars, is that you can repair them by using simple techniques, not, something complicated that you can't accomplish.
Okay, so pillar number two, going into your kitchen. I have three things I want to ask you about. So things that can be healthy for us and okay to keep in our kitchen if we're doing it, and I want to know to what degree. So things like salt, good and bad salt, coffee, good and bad coffee, oil, you know, it should we get rid of all the canola oil and only have olive oil? And, you know, what are your views on those kinds of details?
100%. So, I'm giving 35,000 foot views, but if you want to go into detail, I think seed oils, right? You want to try to avoid. I love olive oil, so I use it. But if you're in a state where your economics determine the fact that you may have to use canola oil sometimes, that you may not be able to afford the extra virgin olive oil, then you may have to do with that, right? But if you can afford it, absolutely, you want to be able to avoid adding to me salt at the table. If you want to cook with salt, I have recipes in my book too, and you can look at those recipes. I hardly put any salt there, but if you want to cook with salt in moderation, it's okay. But just to me, the key is not add it at your table because people are doing it all the time. And especially folks who have diseases like hypertension and cardiovascular disease, it's absolutely important, but for fluid retention, and it's not great for your gut to add excessive amounts of salt to your diet. But I think, again, we can go into the details, but people are not even approaching their kitchen. They're not even spending the time to cook. So that's my point. But to what you're saying, if you can get more specific and really pick the healthier oils, avoid salt, avoid even, ingredients that are processed that you put in your meals if you're preparing them. And I think, again, 80-20, 90-10 rule, if you can, at most of the time, to be able to adhere to these principles, I think you'll do well. Not, if you try to get perfection, you're gonna fail. I have patients who are then, obsessed with this and it takes over their lives. So you don't want to do that. You want to just incorporate that into your life. And that's why I like, if you need a diet, I don't like that, but if you need one, the Mediterranean diet is a great one because it really is pretty simple to do, and it's flexible, right? It's within a construct of having mostly plant-based and very little red meat, and it incorporates also social activity and community, which is my fourth pillar, is to be able to have community when you eat, when you play. Community is so important in what you do, and that abates some of your stress and your fight or flight mechanism as well.
If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with Dr. Partha Nandi. His book, Heal Your Gut, Save Your Brain, The Five Pillars of Enhancing Your Gut and Optimizing Your Cognitive Health. So we've talked about reducing stress hormones. We've talked about going into your kitchen, a little bit about community, being strong in your community. What else?
So community, and I'll expound on that. This is what you're doing, right? With your work and developing a community. And I'd like to have people who've never heard of this, the Rosetto Effect, 1950s, a community in Pennsylvania, Italian immigrants, that when you looked at them had virtually no heart attacks, and they're living to the 80s and 90s. And the only factor, Lynn, that they had that was steps different than the rest of the population was their community. When they talked to each other, they actually listened. They played together, they cooked together, and that protective effect again reduced this opposed cortisol. That's the mechanism that we feel protects people in communities. So as human beings, we survive because of that. The last pillar is spirituality, right? It doesn't mean that you have to pray. If you want to, you can. It doesn't mean you have to go on top of a mountain and do yoga. There are various ways to be spiritual. Just taking 5 or 10 minutes to breathe during your day would be more than not what 95% of people in our country are doing now, right? So just figuring out how what your place is in society and the world is enough to decrease some of those stressors, right? I like meditation. You can do yoga, tai chi, whatever you'd like, but spirituality is the last pillar, and it actually has been shown to affect gut health, right? When you decrease some of this cortisol, when you decrease some of this inflammation, your gut microbiome is more stable. And it's actually creating things like short-chain fatty acids, which help in the gut wall integrity. And that, when you have good gut wall integrity, you have less leaky gut, you have less inflammation. And then consequently, you have less inflammatory conditions in your gut and your brain and the rest of your body. So I think that's why it's important to be able to incorporate these pillars holistically. It's not just, one thing and that's all it is.
I hear so many people here in the Park City area, you know, we love to ski, we love to mountain bike. So many people on a Sunday say, "This is my church. I am out communing with nature." And so, obviously, from what you have just been saying, you would also give that the two thumbs up. But when we're out, when we're doing these things, and you know, you call it's the broad umbrella of spirituality, which could include religion, it could include mindfulness, or you know, going for a bike ride. But give us a few pointers on what we need to really keep in mind if we're going on a bike ride and we're trying to keep up with our buddy who's ahead of us, and it becomes this stressful experience. That's not communing with nature. So,
100%.
few things to remember.
Yeah, I think a healthy competition is great, but when it starts taking over your life, when you become obsessed with the fact that I've got to increase my speed to be able to be this fast or this good, you know, golfers that, you know, are just obsessed with decreasing, you know, their whatever their stroke count, it becomes a different, you're absolutely right, it becomes completely different. What I mean by spirituality and movement with purpose is also you incorporate that. You're basically doing it for the enjoyment, right? You're playing with your kids not to beat them or making sure that your kids don't beat you in basketball, but really you're trying to incorporate your body in tandem with the rest of your life, meaning that you want to be able to move at your own pace. There's no competition here. And what happens is that when you move, I love the fact that if you move and you can make a movement with purpose. And what I mean by that is if you want to spend time with your kids, right? And you're not finding the time, incorporate that movement with your children, right? If you're trying to find time to exercise, but you can't, incorporate it into your life, whether it's gardening, whether it's instead of taking, you know, the elevator, go up the stairs, you know, take the long way, you know, from the parking lot into your building. So these are the ways you'd be able just you have to incorporate it into your life. If you don't incorporate it into your life, then what happens is that you typically fail because you're saying, I'm gonna live my life and then do something else. If you can incorporate it into your life, I think that's the best way. Where I practice, Lynn, in Detroit, I'm next to a super gym, and I love to do something called vulture watching, which is I watch these cars as they circle around the parking lot trying to find the closest space to their gym facility, right? Instead of walking the extra few steps. So those folks who are moving are not really doing that and incorporating that into your life. They're just doing it a couple times a week and then sitting down the rest of the time. It's really important to see if you can do this purposefully, but throughout your life and not just episodically. Even if you're going skiing, I'll go skiing, but the rest of the time I'll do nothing. You have to be able to incorporate it. And these societies that are blue zones, right? They incorporate this into their lives all the time.
Dr. Nandy, as a gastroenterologist and internal medicine specialist, what do you think that whole field is lacking in terms of when we're just looking at it from a Western perspective? And how can we find doctors who are blending these two?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. And I think that here's the thing, right? I'm originally born in India, so I'm kind of a different story because, you know, in India, this is kind of part of general life. So I've had that background, but more and more now, especially younger gastroenterologists and younger physicians in general are really incorporating this into their practice. They themselves are really holistic and they understand the meaning of life and lifestyle changes and a holistic methodology. It's not just give this pill and it's gone because what you're doing is you're doing episodic medicine. It's not preventative medicine. It's basically treating a symptom, right? But if you look at it holistically and you say, okay, where is the symptom coming from? And you can try to get to the root cause and then approach it in that manner. If you're not finding that in your doctor, you know, if this was 1920, 1950, you know, it's difficult. But now, with the power to me of technology, you can find practitioners where you are or perhaps outside of your local area that are practicing this. There are plenty of folks that are holistically minded, and you can find that. And sometimes you can combine your traditional Western doctor with your holistic doctor and have them talk to each other. More and more now, you know, physicians are doing that. So to me, I'm lucky in the fact that I've been able to incorporate that into my practice because of just who I am and my experiences. But if you're not finding that, you know, really talk to them. If they're not open to it, you may have to get somebody else, right? And if they are open to it, but they're not experts, and find a holistic practitioner and have them talk to each other. It's not one or the other. To me, it's the combination of Eastern and Western medicine that'll help us thrive.
Dr. Partha Nandi is my guest, and his book is Heal Your Gut, Save Your Brain. That's the five pillars of enhancing your gut and optimizing your cognitive health. Dr. Nandi, what a pleasure it's been to talk to you. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure for me. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm Jay Burke.
In our world of media upheaval, we wanted to take a different approach with our ongoing series on print media that's thriving. We wanted to honor long-form creativity, beautiful photos, and storytelling that transports you to another world, far away from clickbait and the odd and unfortunate turns of media these days. Today, we're excited for a conversation with Cade Crichco, the founding editor of a magazine called ORI. ORI. It's half of the word origin. It's built for the curiosity seeker, they say, empowered by local creatives around the world. Their timeless collection is an antidote, they say, to the algorithm. Cade joins us to tell us all about it. Cade Crichco, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Amazing. Well, thank you, Lynn, and thank you, Jay. You
Thanks.
gave me the best intro I could have hoped for there. I think we're done here.
Well, hopefully not, because we've got a few minutes to chat here.
All
So
right.
we
Well, the rest is gravy then.
Yeah,
Yeah.
good. Let's get into it a little bit. Ori, first of all, half of origin.
Yeah.
I like that. What's the genesis of that name?
Well, actually, Ori sort of relates to Genesis in general. It's a Latin root that means to appear, to rise, to begin. And originally, I wanted to name the magazine Origen. I had dreams of mixing a little Spanish in there, and my friends told me they wouldn't read my Spanish travel magazine. So I made them happy. I cut it in half, and it's not only a Spanish root, it's also an English root, Portuguese root, all of the Latin languages. So that was the genesis of Ori. But then we started to talk a little bit about origami in Japan, and realized that Ori actually means opportunity in Japanese. And then I had a friend ask me if I knew any Hebrew, and I did not. And he said, well, Ori means light in Hebrew. So all of a sudden we have this very three letters that cross east to west, north to south, and it just kind of felt like destiny.
That's great. Tell us, what do you think long form media is? How do you define that?
I think for us in particular, and some of the other magazines that I've watched pop up and, re-pop up, we've just seen so many magazines come back, right? I think long form is an invitation to slow down and a chance to really dive into a topic that you might find interesting on the internet or on your Instagram, but swipe by, right? So I think long form is this chance to, take a deep dive and really invest yourself in a story, in character, in the writer, the photographer. I try and describe it like that to folks to not go too deep into the weeds, but yeah, it's just this chance to slow down and really absorb something.
There are so many of us out there that really love the print medium and magazines, periodicals, maybe aging ourselves for those of us that really love it. But Mike Rogge from Mountain Gazette, who we were just talking about when before we got on the air, talked about the youth migration to like this long form premium print. Are you seeing that in your readers? Like maybe a little bit of a younger audience that wants to stop the scrolling?
It's funny, you kind of hit on both of our audiences. You mentioned folks that grew up with print, watched it go away, and are now watching it come back. Obviously, we have quite a few of those readers, but then we do have these young readers who grew up essentially without magazines, without these classic publications that had either been on hiatus or shuttered forever. So I think there is, coming from a ski town in the ski world, I think you guys can relate to this idea of nostalgia and the way things used to be. And, every winter was better the year before. And we have these people tuning in that are, have never experienced that banner winter of 77, and they want to. And they see this as an opportunity to do that. So we do have very, very young readers. high school into college readers. That makes it feel like it's not just a flash in the pan thing. It's a shift in culture and what we want as consumers.
What do you find most challenging in this, you know, world where you're bringing something new and that didn't have the legacy of, let's say, like a Powder magazine or something? What do you find most challenging in creating this publication and getting it up and rolling?
Yeah, it's a super good question. I think it's a little bit of a differentiator for us, as you mentioned Powder, but even Mountain Gazette had this long legacy that they were able to kind of kickstart and lean back on. And man, what I would do to have a couple of vintage covers to show folks, you know, what we were about in the 60s, that's just not the case for us. But it's a double-edged sword because we also have the freedom to create something completely new and without anybody telling. We don't have any legacy to really point us in any specific direction. And I think the value in that from a creative standpoint is huge. The challenge, like you said, is getting people to see that value as well. And something we're really doing to connect with that value is investing in our creators, our creatives, meaning our photographers, our writers, our illustrators and artists. And we might be a new publication, but the people we're working with, you know, have Lowell Thomas prizes from the travel world. They were Pulitzer finalists. They, you know, multiple awards in the photography space. So our legacy is sort of through our creatives. And what we're doing is, you know, asking audiences to take a bit of a chance on us, but essentially saying, look, we've established an all-star team. We're not going to let you down on this one. Like, we're putting out a quality product with legacy creatives and packaging it in a new way.
Well, you talk about local creatives around the world. So your creatives, is it always, I assume it's always written in English, or is it translated from other languages? Are these people who just happen to be expats and they're living around the world? Who are they?
Lynn, super good question, because it's a mix of all of that. Something that is a little bit different and we'll call it a challenge as well on my end, is that instead of sending someone someplace to tell a story, report a story, come back and print it in our pages, we're working with somebody on the ground in Mexico City, in Lagos, Nigeria, in, you know, British Columbia and the far reaches of British Columbia. And that takes time. It takes a lot of resources and a lot of internet hunting and phone calls. But I think it provides a bit of a shift in perspective and in our storytelling. That being said, that was the original plan, was to only work with folks that were local, born and bred in an area. And the fact of the matter is, that's not the way the world works. We have people that move in and out of countries. We have people that are from a place but living in another place. We have, you know, we have folks who have dedicated a lot of time to these new places too. And to shut them out just because we're trying to be idealistic, I think is a bit of a misstep and something that we've corrected early on. So what we try and do is we prioritize working with somebody who has spent, you know, at least a year in a place, or they've lived in that place. And then sometimes we will match them with somebody that's also from there, or we'll bring in somebody from outside. So you get this two-hit perspective. You have the new eyes mixed with the old knowledge. And I think that helps provide just like a more well-rounded storytelling base for us. More authentic storytelling with time put in that a lot of journalists don't get otherwise, just because it's hard to send somebody somewhere for 2 years and ask them to report a story, right? So just we're providing a little bit of extra knowledge with every story we put into print.
Well, it's wild because the stories that we tell are, you know, of other places are still seen through the lens of who we are and our culture. And so, for example, absolutely, I happen to be in Central America right now, and, you know, you kind of get used to the scene, but then if you step away from it and look through someone else's eyes who's never been in Central America before, and you go, wow, you know, there are street dogs and chickens running all over, and it just becomes commonplace. So
yes,
it's almost like you have to have the experience of someone who comes from outside to then relate it, make it relatable as a story.
I do think that push and pull is super important. So that idea of having a local teamed up with somebody who is visiting. So you do get the fresh perspective and the immediate reactions, the gut reactions, the, yeah, like you said, the street dogs and the chickens and waking up early in the morning to a rooster call. That's something that somebody might have grown up with and they wouldn't see that, right? Think about living in Park City, walking down Main Street. Are you stopping and taking a picture every time that you walk down Center? No, you're just not doing that. So to have someone with that excitement is really important, I think, but also balancing that with a little bit of cultural nuance, a little bit of local knowledge and local sentiment, especially when we're talking about over tourism and, you know, people visiting and not necessarily being good stewards. You would want somebody to invite you in that situation and tell you, okay, maybe don't do this, but please come spend money here, or, you know, help these businesses out. Like, to have that balance, I think, is something that we're really striving for.
How do you find the writers and the photographers? I mean, in these far flung locations, are they aware of Ori? Are they pitching you, Alma? Or are you finding them, starting with a photographer, starting with a writer? How's that process work for Ori and you as you put a publication together?
That's really interesting. It's a mix of so many of those factors, and obviously starting out, we're young, we're three issues in, we're a biannual, so we only put out two issues a year. And to get the word out at first was a lot of me calling folks that I'd worked with my own journalism. I was 10 years as a international freelancer, so I was traveling to these places and working with these folks in some capacity. So turning around and explaining the new project and getting them on board was a lot of issue one. And then from there, we saw some organic networking where folks would be like, oh, well, you visited Mexico this time. I have a friend in Cuba or Nicaragua that's doing really good work on this particular subject. Would you be interested in working with them? And we pick up some stories that way. And then, you know, the good old fashioned, new fashioned world of social media and spreading the word. We are print only, but we are not digital averse, I like to say. We definitely operate on the internet on some level. Twitter X and Instagram have been our friends as far as spreading the word. So each magazine you hold and you see is a combination of those three things. Hopefully one day it'll be 100% pitches coming from around the world, but sometimes you need to curate some of the content you want, and maybe we want to go to Morocco this time. Let's go find somebody in Morocco that can tell a story.
Well, that is a good segue to a program that you guys offer, which is the Ori Creative Grant, I believe you call it.
The Ori Creative Grant is also born from life as a freelancer and, you know, being frustrated a little bit about something that people might not know about journalists is in our world of R&D, basically that's us going out and researching stories. We're not paid for that. We go out, we find these stories. A lot of people put their lives on a limb to go and make that happen. But there's no guarantee that story gets sold, and there's no guarantee a person sees a dollar from it. And that's a huge time commitment and money commitment that buries a lot of people. I wanted to reverse that a little bit by paying it forward with the help of our subscribers. So what the Ori Creative Grant is essentially is every person who subscribes, we take 2% of their subscription revenue, not profit, and we're putting it in a pot. And as we get more subscribers, that pot obviously grows. And when the magazine comes out, we turn back to our readers, and instead of, you know, doing an exit poll, we ask them straight up, like, what was your favorite piece from that issue? And we tally the votes, and the creative team that has the most votes, we give the money that we've raised to that creative, paying it forward, non-binding grant. And we say, use this to tell your next story. Whatever you spend it on doesn't matter to us, because we know it's going to go into reporting. We know it's going into keeping you afloat for that next gig to come in. We know it's going to keep you telling stories. So imagine printing a story and getting, you know, 1,000 pats on the back for it and $2,000, you know, it's a pretty sweet gig. And I was surprised that no one else was doing this. So I'm kind of encouraging other magazines to copy us. I would love to see this everywhere. I think it's a way that we could potentially provide some sustainability in a volatile media world.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with the founding editor of Ori magazine, Cade Crichco. Before we get into the stories, Cade, I wanted to ask you what you think, and maybe this is a more of an existential question, but what has clickbait done to us as readers? How has it changed the way we think, the way we read?
I think we've become goldfish. I think that we consume and regurgitate and defecates the, not the word I'm looking for, but it goes through us, right? And we get a lot of information, but we rarely retain that information. And I feel like, you know, dinner table conversations have suffered as a result. I think that a lot of us know a lot wider. We have a wider knowledge base, but not as deep of a knowledge base, if that makes sense. Yeah, we're lacking the connection to the media that we used to have. And not to just to the media, to these very human stories and human elements. And I think it's so easy to discard human stories right now because there's just so many. How can we possibly process all of those stories? So I may have gotten a little too existential and potentially even a little dark on you there, but I just see this like temporal nature to the way we consume. Mm-hmm. And it bums me out some days. I'm just as guilty of this as the next person, but right. I want an excuse to get lost in something.
I don't even know when that first story came out, and I won't even mention the magazine, but the top 10 places to, you know, XYZ in the world, you know, people really lament the fact that those lists came about, either because they feel like it ruined your secret spot, your secret town, your secret experience. But it also shaped us as readers that we trained to look at those things and not beyond. And so tell us about some of the stories in Ori that go beyond.
Man, I have so many that come to mind already. And I think just to home in on your point a little bit is Ori does not publish lists. That is something that we do not do. And I am personally struggling with our branding a little bit in the sense that we live in the travel space, but we're not a travel magazine. We're a magazine for travelers. We're a magazine, like you'd mentioned earlier, for curiosity seekers, because we feel like the more you know, the better you travel. It's not the tips that help you, it's the knowledge. But we want people that want to learn about places and then go create their own experience based off of the knowledge they get from our pages. We'll take areas that are pretty popular, right? We'll look at a Mexico City because we know people are going to be visiting that place. Why do you visit Mexico City? You visit for the art, you visit for the food, you visit for the music, the architecture, all these things, right? It's a beautiful, beautiful place. So we took those elements and we looked into how it was affecting people on the ground, and we connected with this writer. When you mention, do you translate your articles? Yes, we do translate our articles. So this was written in Spanish and we translated it to English. I'm also the translator, not just the intern. So that was an interesting challenge. But the story is about taco trucks and this very specific art form around it. Basically the fonts that bring you in, the big signs, the bright colors, the design that people absolutely love when they're down in Mexico City. It's a very specific type of art called rotulos. And those are currently under attack by the local government. They're trying to paint them over and put up political propaganda as, you know, advertising space. And so you're seeing an area be basically whitewashed of this art that brings an entire city, an entire country together. So there's this fight by local artists around the food truck scene to preserve this art form and preserve a culture. That's an example of a story we tell. You can enter that on multiple levels, right? You can just look at the pictures and you have beautiful artwork, amazing food, really cool, fun characters, and you're going to have a great time. That's excellent. You can do a surface read and you can learn about rotulos, this art form that you didn't know about. And if you really want to dive in deep, this is level three, you can learn about gentrification in a place that a lot of us are visiting and a lot of us are spending extended time in. So I do think our stories are more or less a celebration of the vibrancy of the world rather than, you know, the negative news cycle. But there are elements here that are interesting and are dynamic. Can I follow it up with the article that appears right afterwards is an article on bodega cats in New York City. So we have an entire cat album in our first issue that actually won us an American Photography Award
Oh.
because cats are part of the culture here in New York City. They sit in the bodegas and they get rid of the rodents, and they're like the talismans of these corner stores that bring in stockbrokers from Wall Street and also, single moms of three that just moved here from a different country, and they all mingle in the same place. And we just felt like that was a cool way to celebrate a city that has so much going on. So we brought in a photographer from The New Yorker, and he did a fashion shoot with a bunch of cats.
Does the photographer come first, or does the journalist, the writer, come first? I mean, do you have a like hard and true kind of approach to that?
And we've had several readers say this to me, is that the pictures bring you in, the stories keep you there, and the design really unites both of those things. Trying to keep it relatively simple and clean, very easy to digest. But as far as me approaching how I assign my stories, it's super story dependent. Some stories just lend themselves more to a visual, so we'll keep words light, or other stories are denser, and we will figure out the photos on the fly, but it's really about the writer. And we've brought in illustrators. We will really fully cater to our writer if it's a written story. A good example of that is in our last issue, we did an entire expose on postcards and the history of postcards, because I feel like that was like the one traveler memento that a lot of people can relate to. Like, why are we in the middle of the highway in Iowa, stopping at a gas station, picking up a piece of cardboard, writing, "Hey, the weather's nice here, I miss you," and putting it in the mail? Where does that come from? Where does that urge come from, Turns out it comes from a British comedian back in the 1700s who sent a postcard in the mail as a joke. I didn't know this before I reported it, but how do you photograph a postcard feature, right? That was a challenge, but there's illustration, collage, we set up some studio stuff, but ultimately that story was very word heavy.
And one jumped out, which was from Provo Canyon, and I saw one of the featured, which was really cool, which is right in our backyard. But paint this picture. I walk out for our listeners, I walk out and I grab the magazine out of the mailbox. Tell us a little bit what you find, size, paper quality, and then also maybe touch on how you view advertising a little bit.
I never thought I'd be a paper nerd, Jay, but I can tell you a year and change into this, I know everything about paperweight. I know everything about finish, spines, all of it. Our magazine is very intentional in the way we lay things out. It's an uncoated magazine, so it's not shiny, glossy like you see at the doctor's office. This is more of an art style, coffee table style book. We actually said the standard size is the new avant-garde in magazines. It's getting to the point where some people are doing it well and others aren't. And we thought, well, how can we have a travel magazine that doesn't fit in a backpack? That just doesn't make sense. So we have a standard size. It's 128 pages, so it's on the thicker side, real thick paper stock. With a thick paper stock, it doesn't open as easily, we started to find. So we actually have a special bind that's more like a book bind that allows our magazine to open all the way flat. Which allows photography to run full bleed one end to the other. We're big on spreads. Again, photography heavy, like you said. We don't want to lose people in the gutter. There's nothing worse. So gutter being the middle of the magazine, we don't want to lose people there. Yeah, it's definitely coming from an art point of view. It's not the magazines I grew up with, and that's totally fine. We're seeing an evolution in the magazines that are coming out. We're producing less of them. We are making them better, and we are making them last longer. And part of making them better, I do think that advertising plays a part in what we're doing. But the game shifted a little bit. I think that we're looking at less advertising interruptions and more advertising collaboration. So we do run ads, but we only run spreads. We do that because we want to give any ad partner of ours a chance to tell a fuller story and really invite them to be a part of the magazine. Like, "Hey, this looks nice. Why would you put a half-baked ad in this magazine that you're not proud of?" We want our advertisers to really be proud of what goes into our pages. But you know, that's a slow burn as far as convincing people to, you know, take a leap and do something a little bigger and really partner with us, not just throw an ad at it, because people are throwing ads at banner ads, are throwing ads at Instagram, are throwing ads at Meta to get the numbers. We're after lifelong customers. So we want people to see the ad the first time, and then they're going to pick up the magazine again and they're going to see it a second time. And if they hate it, well, then we've just wasted that space. So we have, like I said, select ad partners right now. We're open to more, but we've got a cap set. So once we hit that, we know we're good. You know, early on, we don't have the legacy pedigree that some of these other magazines have, where they can just say, oh yeah, look at what we've done, and like sign on the dotted line. We have to prove ourselves issue in and issue out. So far, we've had some people jump on that have really said, hey, we believe in you. Just like we're saying, hey, we believe in our creatives. And that's been huge to us. Sun Valley was somebody who jumped on very early and kind of out of left field. They approached us and were like, this is the market we're going for. You guys are positioned perfectly at the intersection of this mountain life that we all love and live, and the cities and the people who want to get to that mountain life. And that's where we are. I'm in Brooklyn right now. You know, I'm not in Brooklyn because I like the weather. I'm in Brooklyn because I know this is the market that wants to be in Park City, that wants to be in Sun Valley, that wants to fly to Seattle for the weekend and, you know, do something crazy and have this experience. And so that's kind of who we're going after and who we're hoping to work with advertisers to bring to these places.
Cabe Kritschko is the founding editor of Ori magazine. It's O-R-I. How do we find you?
ORI-MAG.com. We're offering gift subscriptions right now, so this is the easiest time actually to get involved. A gift subscription essentially lets you gift the magazine to whoever you want. You'll pay for that first year, which is 2 issues. And then after that, the subscription will kick over to them and they can decide whether or not they want to keep going with it. So they get a trial run. You're the hero at Christmas. And if you want some immediate gratification, you can also add single issues to that. So we do have a couple of back issues. So if you want to actually physically hand something to somebody, totally get that. We've got you covered as well. It's all on our website, ORI-MAG.com.
All right, Cabe, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having you guys.